Hello, and welcome to Spartan Spirits Leadership, where we take a close look at your leaders and just how well they are looking after Western society's best interests. I'm your host, Bill Kurilakis. I'm a retired senior Air Force officer, and today we're going to look at what Julianne Smith had to say about defense spending, or more specifically, the commitment to spending 2% of gross domestic product on defense. As always, my aim is to focus on Western values of democracy, individual rights, and most of all, a nation-first perspective, because they are the foundation of Western societies, and I think they're worth fighting for. The issue today is defense spending. I decided to cover this topic after hearing Donald Trump speaking about nations that were not achieving the targets of 2% GDP spending on defense. And he said, and this is a quote, "No, I would not protect you. In fact, I would encourage them to do whatever the hell they want. You gotta pay," end quote. And by them, he was referring to Russia. And this was in relation to NATO countries, generally speaking, who were not paying their 2% GDP. The inference here, of course, is that Trump might not meet the U.S.'s treaty obligations under Article 5 of the NATO Treaty, which says that all NATO members will defend each other in the case of attack. That has grave implications for the international security framework, and we're going to unpick this issue of defense spending today. We're going to do that by looking at what GDP means, why 2% is the benchmark for defense spending in the Western world, which nations use 2% as a reference point, and what 2% does for global security. We'll then consider how Western leaders are or aren't meeting their defense spending obligations, and we'll wrap it up by looking at what Julianne Smith had to say about it. And for those who are unfamiliar with who Julianne Smith is, she's Joe Biden's ambassador to NATO. Let's start with a refresher on just what gross domestic product means. According to the International Monetary Fund, GDP measures the monetary value of final goods and services, that is, produced in a country in a given time period, usually measured per year. This includes all of the output generated within the borders of a country composed of goods and services produced for sale in the market, but it also includes some non-market productions such as defense or education services provided by the government. There are many measures available, but that's the common way it's used in Western nations. Defense spending can also be measured in different ways. Western nations focus on all military-related expenditure, but other countries follow different conventions. Some exclude internal security expenditures, which can be relatively high for a few countries, thus lowering their percent spending of GDP on defense. Others, such as Russia, exclude some defense-related items, such as research and development and reserves, thereby significantly reducing their measure of defense spending. Despite these variations, most Western nations, particularly NATO nations, have agreed on measuring defense spending by dividing their defense expenses by their GDP to arrive at a percentage. You can find out how this came to be by doing a search, for example, on a ChatGPT, which is what I did to give you the following information. And it summarized global security implications of 2% spending as the following. Firstly, it provides for adequate defense spending to enhance a nation's military capabilities, readiness, and deterrence. As for collective security, meeting the 2% target strengthens NATO's ability to respond collectively to threats. As a deterrent, a well-funded military discourages aggression and promotes stability. As a crisis response, sufficient spending enables rapid deployment during crises, for example, humanitarian assistance or evacuation operations, or war if you really need to. 2% GDP is also a strategic message. It demonstrates commitment to defense and resolve amongst allies. So let's look now at three examples to see what this means in practice. The U.S. spends somewhere between 3-4% of GDP on defense. Because it has a very large economy, that equates to a lot of money, about $800 billion per year. Compare this to Greece, which also spends well over 3% of its GDP on defense. But because Greece has a low GDP, this equates to only about $8 billion for 2022. That's US dollars. That's a paltry amount when you consider what it takes to run the sort of defense measures that Greece has in place to protect its territory from Turkey. Now let's look at Japan. For most of the past 60 years, Japan spent just under 1% of GDP. The low number was due to a restriction imposed by the West after World War II. It crested to 1.1% in 2022, but due to its large economy, that 1% equates to over US $50 billion a year. Compare all of these to the world average of 2.2% GDP. Although it's somewhat useful to know the dollar amounts, when countries and alliances compare expenditures, they want to understand what each country in a given alliance is pulling as its fair share. And that fair share assessment is percent GDP. Now let's look at the history of how Western nations came to use this measure. Prior to 1974, NATO did not track defense expenditure as a measure of percent GDP. At the 1977 London summit, NATO nations agreed that the percent GDP target should be set at 3% GDP. This has been amended over the intervening years, and many nations markedly drew down their defense spending in the aftermath of the breakup of the Soviet Union in 1990, and of course, that's because NATO was created to defend against the Soviet Union. However, as we know, tensions rose through the 1990s and the early 2000s, leading NATO to setting the latest target of 2% in 2006. In the aftermath of Russia's annexation of the Crimea in 2014, NATO nations reaffirmed their commitment to 2% defense spending. And the reason they had to do that was because many of them weren't actually achieving the 2%. In fact, only three nations were. Now, the reason NATO believes in setting a common defense spending target is that NATO is underpinned by the notion of collective defense. That concept is enshrined in Article 5 of the NATO Treaty, which stipulates that an attack on any member country is an equivalent to an attack on all its members. Thus, to share the defense burden fairly, each nation is expected to spend 2% of their GDP on defense. Although one could easily argue that defense spending should match the threats of the moment rather than some predetermined amount, this measure is now commonly quoted in the US media as the standard expected of US allies, by the US, of course, even for non-NATO nations like Australia, New Zealand, and Japan. So, for example, when it was adopted by Australia, it sparked a debate about how to determine defense spending. The short story for Australia, though, is that 2% was agreed as the target by both major Australian parties in the lead-up to the 2013 election because of a comparison that was made at the time that noted Australia's defense spending had fallen to pre-World War II levels. Put another way, it was a political stunt to shore up defense votes. But the policy stuck, because while Australia was lowering its percent GDP, several key US pundits commented negatively about Australia's defense spending. For example, Admiral Samuel Locklear, commander of the US Pacific Command, as well as former Deputy Secretary of Defense in the Bush administration, Rich Armitage, and Senator John McCain, then ranking member of the US Senate Armed Services Committee, all made comments on the decrease in Australian defense spending. Armitage called the new defense funding figures post the 2012-13 budget inadequate and accused Australia of wanting a free ride from the United States. Put more bluntly, Locklear said that Australia's defense spending had fallen below the level the United States expected of its allies. That political pressure from the U.S. has only heightened in recent years. Thus, the question then becomes, as Donald Trump put it, what happens when a nation fails to pay its fair share? Does it cede its right to collective self-defense in NATO? What about Australia, New Zealand, and Japan? Should they expect U.S. support if they aren't spending 2% of GDP on defense? Let's look at who is and who isn't committing their fair share, according to the 2% measure, in terms of the West's collective defense. We'll start with NATO. In 2014, as I mentioned earlier, only three nations were meeting the 2% target. But fast forward 10 years later, and with an existential threat knocking on Europe's door, Russia, 18 of the 31 nations are expected to hit 2% or more in 2024. And for the first time in NATO's history, the total European commitment will be 2% of the combined EU GDP. Of course, with 13 of 31 nations still under 2%, that means there's an unequal sharing of that defense burden. And that's what Trump is talking about. As we heard earlier, the US and Greece tend to be the biggest contributors in terms of percent GDP. The United Kingdom sits around 2% GDP, as do many of the nations that are geographically close to the Ukraine. Surprise, surprise. They're the ones that would suffer if Russia sought to regain lost Soviet territories. Looking at NATO's two newest members, Finland was already at or over 2% when it joined. And Sweden, which was at 1.4% in 2022, has dramatically increased defense spending and has budgeted for 2% in 2024. That's a huge rise. Now that's real commitment. And again, no surprises there, right? Russia borders Finland on the east, and Sweden is next in line after Finland, as well as having to face Russia in the Baltic Sea. Let's change gears here. Let's take a quick look at Canada. Despite 10 years of pledges to attain 2% GDP on defense, Canada sat at 1.3% in 2022, or $37 billion Canadian dollars, making Canada one of the lowest contributors to defense spending in NATO. Compare that to Australia's 2.1%, or about $50 billion Australian dollars, which would be about $45 billion Canadian. So a country of, say, 25 million is spending 50% more than the country of 35 million, with a very similar mindset in terms of defense and military construct. It's quite informative and speaks to the defense posture that each of Canada and Australia takes. And of course, Canada has not a lot to worry about geographically, whereas Australia does. And in terms of trade and sea lines of communication or other lines of communication, the bulk of Canada's trade is coming from the United States, whereas Australia needs to keep those lines of communication open. And so defense really matters a lot more to Australia, and it's evident in their spending. And finally, let's look at two other key democracies, New Zealand and India. New Zealand sits at about 1.5%, and India is just under 2%. So we now have a good feel for who's pulling their weight on defense spending. We understand that the 2% GDP mark is something that Western democracies are generally aiming towards as a measure of pulling their fair share of the defense burden. This mark was set as a rough means of ensuring that everyone in NATO does their fair share, and the US uses the 2% mark as a benchmark to assess how their other allies are contributing to the collective defense of Western democracies. So now let's turn our attention to what Western leaders have been saying about defense spending, with some focus on Trump's recent missive about what should happen to those nations that don't pull their weight. We'll start with Lloyd Austin, the US Secretary of Defense, and these are a few quotes from Lloyd. "NATO is the strongest military alliance in history, and it's crucial for America's continued security. The United States will continue to stand with our NATO allies and to defend the sovereignty and territory of every alliance member, every inch of it. Our commitment to Article 5 remains ironclad." And he went on to say, "The Secretary General projects that in 2024, 18 allies will spend at least 2% of their GDP on defense, a major improvement over 2014 when only 3 hit that target. Any ally not spending at least 2% of GDP on defense this year should have plans to swiftly meet that target." End quote. Now, Austin didn't say what happens if you don't, but there's clearly some pressure coming from the US there in that statement to those allies that don't hit 2%. Of course, European leaders, particularly those geographically closer to Russia, had some comments to make about Trump's words on defense spending. For example, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz posted on social media saying that, quote, "Any relativization of NATO's support guarantee is irresponsible and dangerous, and is in the interest of Russia alone." And he went on to say, "No one can play or deal with Europe's security," end quote. And those words were clearly aimed at Trump. Moving closer to Russia, Kaja Kallas, who's the Prime Minister of Estonia, said that Trump's comments should be a wake-up call for allies to spend more on defense. And of course, Estonia should be really worried about Russia's future intentions. From the NATO Secretary General, Jens Stoltenberg, who I've mentioned many times in previous episodes, I finally got some good words out of Jan, and he said, quote, "Any suggestion that allies will not defend each other undermines all of our security. I expect that regardless of who wins the presidential election, the U.S. will remain a strong and committed NATO ally," end quote. And of course, we need Jens Stoltenberg and his peers to be saying things like this to make sure that the U.S. continues to support NATO. To combine the U.S. and NATO views, now let's hear from U.S. Ambassador to NATO, Julianne Smith. For those unfamiliar with Ambassador Smith, she spent most of her career involved with national security sectors with a focus on NATO, and she also spent time as the Deputy National Security Advisor in the Obama administration. Her perspective includes a few points, and I'm going to cover off on them. And these are a series of quotes available from U.S. media outlets like the New York Times or CBS News, where she's been widely quoted. Here we go. She started off by saying, "There are no dues owing at NATO." And what she meant by that was 2% is the aim point, but not everyone achieves it. She's trying to be diplomatic in her approach here. And she pointed out that more than half of NATO does indeed contribute 2% or more. Mind you, that's a very recent trend, as I mentioned earlier. And it's obviously driven by the Russian attack on Ukraine. She went on to say allies need to invest in their own defense, and collectively, the NATO will be stronger if everyone does that. Smith also noted that despite Trump's comments, the U.S. Congress has been generally supportive of NATO. And she said, quote, "I want to ensure that both Democrats and Republicans remain involved and excited about what this alliance is doing," end quote. And she went on to say, "Encouraging the Kremlin to attack NATO allies is irrational and dangerous." That was a direct comment in relation to Trump's words. And she said that those sorts of words put U.S. soldiers and allies in Europe and their soldiers at risk and increased danger. Referencing funding for the Ukraine that was stalled for months in the U.S. government, Smith said, quote, "They need this assistance now. The Ukrainians are fighting to defend their own territory, but they're also fighting to defend the values that we hold dear. We need to stop Russia now in Ukraine, get the Russians out of Ukraine so they don't get any second thoughts about going further westward and moving into NATO territory," end quote. Now, that's the gold statement that came out of Smith. I'm particularly glad to hear that quote because it succinctly expresses what the focus should be for Western nations. It's about defending Western values. That's what's best for the West. And how we do that is by having militaries that are capable of high-intensity conflict. I'll just reiterate that quote again because I think it's really important. Quote, "The Ukrainians are fighting to defend their own territory, but they're also fighting to defend the values that we hold dear," end quote. In other words, the Ukraine is fighting for Western values, democracy, individual rights, and nations. While some argue that the 2% figure is just a political stunt and that government should be focused on spending to achieve the required effect, which I agree does make more sense, it doesn't matter what the logic is. The fact remains, in periods of heightened security threats, Western governments owe it to Western society to spend more on defense to put a stop to those threats. In the case of Russia, NATO, the US, and its allies like Australia and Japan, that means spending big now, before the first missiles and shells start flying into Europe, because how well a military is prepared for day one of any given war will dictate how it can perform in the early stages of combat. Just look at the wrecks of unprepared militaries throughout history. Being unprepared is tantamount to defeatism and being unpatriotic. And with that in mind, we should take a hard look at defense spending from another angle. Instead of saying everybody should meet 2% as the mark, let's ask this question, is 2% enough? Consider how Ukraine is chewing through ammunition and hardware. The West is struggling to supply the Ukraine. How would we go across a broad war versus Russia or China or even against Iran? If 2% isn't enough, what is? Greece routinely spends close to 4% GDP on defense. In 2023, Polish Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki said Poland would increase its defense spending to 4%. I don't think they actually got there, but at least he had the intention. And to give you some additional perspective of what it takes to go to war, let's look at some historical examples of percent GDP. In 1953, the peak year of the Korean War, defense spending in the U.S. was 14% of GDP. In 1968, at the height of the Vietnam conflict, U.S. defense spending was 9.5% of GDP. And in 1986, at the peak of the Reagan rearmament strategy, it was 6.2%. And Russia, at the moment, is spending around 15% GDP. If you think these numbers are high, you need to remember that combat destroys equipment and consumes huge quantities of ammunition. That all costs money. Also, more personnel are needed, thus driving up personnel costs. And finally, dealing with wounded soldiers is yet another cost that could skyrocket. If you accept that Western nations should be doing more in the Ukraine, should be preparing for conflict with Russia, China, or maybe Iran, then 2% starts to look anemic. It's nowhere near enough. I'd suggest that it's time we start talking about 4% GDP. And while Trump's words are divisive and represent petty politics, the concept of holding all of NATO's feet to the fire on expenditure has to be just the starting point for a tougher discussion. And, as Julianne Smith said, that discussion is all about just how much do we in the West actually value our freedom, our democracy, our individual rights. I, for one, value them a lot, and I would be happy to support markedly increased defense spending. I think that is what's best for the West. That's a wrap for today. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and if you did, please share a link with someone and give the podcast a rating. I'm going to have to extend these podcasts now to one per month because I've picked up a little bit of part-time work and it's going to consume me. Thanks for listening, and I look forward to talking to you again in 4 weeks' time.